When I refer to them, incidentally, it's only as a part of my progress. Having some foundation for believing by this time that nature and accident had made me an author, I pursued my vocation with confidence. Without such assurance, I should certainly have left it alone and bestowed my energy on some other endeavour. I should have tried to find out what nature and accident really had made me, and to be that and nothing else. I had been writing, in the newspaper and elsewhere, so prosperously that when my new success was achieved, I considered myself reasonably entitled to escape from the dreary debates. One joyful night, therefore, I noted down the music of the parliamentary bagpipes for the last time, and I have never heard it since. Though I still recognise the old drone in the newspapers without any substantial variation, except perhaps that there's more of it, all the livelong session. I now write of the time when I'd been married, I suppose, about a year and a half. After several varieties of experiment, we had given up the housekeeping as a bad job. The house kept itself, and we kept a page. The principal function of this retainer was to quarrel with the cook, in which respect he was a perfect Whittington without his cat or the remotest chance of being made Lord Mayor. He appears to me to have lived in a hail of saucepan lids. His whole existence was a scuffle. He would shriek for help on the most improper occasions, as when we had a little dinner party or a few friends in the evening, and would come tumbling out of the kitchen with iron missiles flying after him. We wanted to get rid of him, but he was very attached to us and wouldn't go. He was a tearful boy, and broke into such deplorable lamentations when a cessation of our connection was hinted at, that we were obliged to keep him. He had no mother, no anything in the way of a relative that I could discover, except a sister who fled to America the moment we'd taken him off her hands, and he became quartered on us like a horrible young changeling. He had a lively perception of his own unfortunate state, and was always rubbing his eyes with the sleeve of his jacket, or stooping to blow his nose on the extreme corner of a little pocket handkerchief, which he never would take completely out of his pocket, but always economised and secreted. This unlucky page, engaged in an evil hour at £6.10 per annum, was a source of continual trouble to me. I watched him as he grew, and he grew like scarlet beans, with painful apprehensions of the time when he would begin to shave, even of the days when he would be bald or grey. I saw no prospect of ever getting rid of him, and projecting myself into the future, used to think what an inconvenience he would be when he was an old man. I never expected anything less than this unfortunate's manner of getting me out of my difficulty. He stole Dora's watch, which, like everything else belonging to us, had no particular place of its own, and, converting it into money, spent the produce, he was always a weak-minded boy, in incessantly riding up and down between London and Uxbridge outside the coach. He was taken to Bow Street, as well as I remember, on the completion of his 15th journey, when 4 and 6 and a second-hand fife which he couldn't play were found upon his person. The surprise and its consequences would have been much less disagreeable to me if he hadn't been penitent. But he was very penitent indeed, and in a peculiar way, not in the lump, but by instalments. For example, the day after that on which I was obliged to appear against him, he made certain revelations touching a hamper in the cellar, which we believed to be full of wine, but which had nothing in it except bottles and corks. We supposed he had now eased his mind and told the worst he knew of the cook. But a day or two afterwards his conscience sustained a new twinge, and he disclosed how she had a little girl who, early every morning, took away our bread, and also how he himself had been suborned to maintain the milkman in coals. In 2 or 3 days more, I was informed by the authorities of his having led to the discovery of sirloins of beef among the kitchen stuff and sheets in the rag bag. A little while afterwards, he broke out in an entirely new direction and confessed to a knowledge of burglarious intentions as to our premises on the part of the potboy, who was immediately taken up. I got to be so ashamed of being such a victim that I would have given him any money to hold his tongue, or would have offered a round bribe for his being permitted to run away. It was an aggravating circumstance in the case that he had no idea of this, but conceived that he was making me amends in every new discovery, not to say heaping obligations on my head. At last, I ran away myself, whenever I saw an emissary of the police approaching with some new intelligence, and lived a stealthy life until he was tried and ordered to be transported. Even then he couldn't be quiet, but was always writing us letters, and wanted so much to see Dora before he went away that Dora went to visit him, and fainted when she found herself inside the iron bars. In short, I had no peace of my life until he was expatriated, and made, as I afterwards heard, a shepherd of up the country somewhere. I've no geographical idea where. All this led me into some serious reflections, and presented our mistakes in a new aspect, as I couldn't help communicating to Dora one evening, in spite of my tenderness for her. "My love," said I, "it's very painful to me to think that our want of system and management involves not only ourselves, which we've got used to, but other people." "You've been silent for a long time, and now you're going to be cross," said Dora. "No, my dear, indeed. Let me explain to you what I mean." "I think I don't want to know," said Dora. "But I want you to know, my love. Put Jip down." Dora put his nose to mine and said, "Boo!" to drive my seriousness away. But not succeeding, ordered him into his pagoda, and sat looking at me with her hands folded and a most resigned little expression of countenance. "The fact is, my dear," I began, "there is contagion in us. We infect everyone about us." I might have gone on in this figurative manner if Dora's face hadn't admonished me that she was wondering with all her might whether I was going to propose any new kind of vaccination or other medical remedy for this unwholesome state of ours. Therefore I checked myself and made my meaning plainer. "It is not merely, my pet," said I, "that we lose money and comfort and even temper sometimes by not learning to be more careful, but that we incur the serious responsibility of spoiling everyone who comes into our service or has any dealings with us. I begin to be afraid that the fault is not entirely on one side, but that these people all turn out ill because we don't turn out very well ourselves." "Oh! What an accusation!" exclaimed Dora, opening her eyes wide. "To say that you ever saw me take gold watches! Oh! My dearest," I remonstrated, "don't talk preposterous nonsense. Who has made the least allusion to gold watches?" "You did," returned Dora. "You know you did. You said I hadn't turned out well and compared me to him." "To whom?" I asked. "To the page," sobbed Dora. "Oh, you cruel fellow, to compare your affectionate wife to a transported page. Why didn't you tell me your opinion of me before we were married? Why didn't you say, you hard-hearted thing, that you were convinced I was worse than a transported page? Oh, what a dreadful opinion to have of me! Oh, my goodness!" "Now, Dora, my love," I returned gently, trying to remove the handkerchief she pressed to her eyes, "this is not only very ridiculous of you, but very wrong. In the first place, it's not true." "You always said he was a storyteller," sobbed Dora, "and now you say the same of me. Oh, what shall I do? What shall I do?" "My darling girl," I retorted, "I really must entreat you to be reasonable and listen to what I did say and do say. My dear Dora, unless we learn to do our duty to those whom we employ, they will never learn to do their duty to us. I'm afraid we present opportunities to people to do wrong that never ought to be presented. Even if we were as lax as we are in all our arrangements by choice, which we are not, even if we liked it and found it agreeable to be so, which we don't, I am persuaded we should have no right to go on in this way. We're positively corrupting people. We're bound to think of that. I can't help thinking of it, Dora. It's a reflection I am unable to dismiss, and it sometimes makes me very uneasy. There, dear, that's all. Come now, don't be foolish." But Dora would not allow me for a long time to remove the handkerchief. She sat sobbing and murmuring behind it that if I was uneasy, why had I ever been married? Why hadn't I said even the day before we went to church that I knew I should be uneasy and I would rather not? If I couldn't bear her, why didn't I send her away to her aunt's at Putney or to Julia Mills in India? Julia would be glad to see her and wouldn't call her a transported page. Julia never had called her anything of the sort. In short, Dora was so afflicted, and so afflicted me by being in that condition, that I felt it was of no use repeating this kind of effort, though never so mildly, and I must take some other course. What other course was left to take? To form her mind? This was a common phrase of words which had a grave and promising sound, and I resolved to form Dora's mind. I began immediately. When Dora was very childish, and I would have infinitely preferred to humour her, I tried to be grave, and disconcerted her and myself too. I talked to her on the subjects which occupied my thoughts, and I read Shakespeare to her, and fatigued her to the last degree. I accustomed myself to giving her, as it were quite casually, little scraps of useful information or sound opinion, and she started from them when I let them off as if they'd been crackers. No matter how incidentally or naturally I endeavoured to form my little wife's mind, I couldn't help seeing that she always had an instinctive perception of what I was about, and became a prey to the keenest apprehensions. In particular, it was clear to me that she thought Shakespeare a terrible fellow. The formation went on very slowly. I pressed Traddles into the service without his knowledge, and whenever he came to see us, exploded my mines upon him for the edification of Dora at second hand. The amount of practical wisdom I bestowed upon Traddles in this manner was immense and of the best quality, but it had no other effect upon Dora than to depress her spirits and make her always nervous with the dread that it would be her turn next. I found myself in the condition of a schoolmaster. A trap, a pitfall. I'm always playing spider to Dora's fly and always pouncing out of my hole to her infinite disturbance. Still, looking forward through this intermediate stage to the time when there should be a perfect sympathy between Dora and me, and when I should have formed her mind to my entire satisfaction, I persevered even for months. Finding at last, however, that although I had been all this time a very porcupine or hedgehog, bristling all over with determination, I had effected nothing, it began to occur to me that perhaps Dora's mind was already formed. On further consideration, this appeared so likely that I abandoned my scheme, which had had a more promising appearance in words than in action, resolving henceforth to be satisfied with my child wife, and to try to change her into nothing else by any process. I was heartily tired of being sagacious and prudent by myself, and of seeing my darling under restraint. So I bought a pretty pair of earrings for her and a collar for Jip, and went home one day to make myself agreeable. Dora was delighted with the little presents, and kissed me joyfully. But there was a shadow between us, however slight, and I had made up my mind that it shouldn't be there. If there must be such a shadow anywhere, I would keep it for the future in my own breast. I sat down by my wife on the sofa and put the earrings in her ears, and then I told her that I feared we had not been quite as good company lately as we used to be, and that the fault was mine, which I sincerely felt, and which indeed it was. "The truth is, Dora, my life," I said, "I have been trying to be wise."
"And to make me wise, too," said Dora timidly. "Haven't you, Dodie?"
I nodded assent to the pretty inquiry of the raised eyebrows, and kissed the parted lips.
"It's not a bit of use," said Dora, shaking her head, until the earrings rang again. "You know what a little thing I am, and what I wanted you to call me from the first. If you can't do so, I'm afraid you'll never like me. Are you sure you don't think sometimes it would have been better to have..."
"Done what, my dear?"
for she made no effort to proceed.
"Nothing," said Dora.
"Nothing," I repeated. She put her arms round my neck and laughed and called herself by her favourite name of a goose, and hid her face on my shoulder in such a profusion of curls that it was quite a task to clear them away and see it.
"Don't I think it would have been better to have done nothing than to have tried to form my little wife's mind?" said I, laughing at myself. "Is that the question?"
"Yes, indeed, I do."
"Is that what you've been trying?" cried Dora. "Oh, what a shocking boy!"
"But I shall never try any more," said I, "for I love her dearly as she is."
"Without a story?"
"Really?"
inquired Dora, creeping closer to me.
"Why should I seek to change," said I, "what has been so precious to me for so long? You never can show better than as your own natural self, my sweet Dora. And we'll try no conceited experiments, but go back to our old way and be happy."
"And be happy," returned Dora. "Yes, all day. And you won't mind things going a tiny morsel wrong sometimes?"
"No, no," said I, "we must do the best we can." "And you won't tell me any more that we make other people bad," coaxed Dora, "will you? Because, you know, it's so dreadfully cross."
"No, no," said I.
This ends side one of cassette 22. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.
"It's better for me to be stupid than uncomfortable, isn't it?"
said Dora. "Better to be naturally Dora than anything else in the world."
"In the world? Oh, Jodie, it's a large place."
She shook her head, turned her delighted, bright eyes up to mine, kissed me, broke into a merry laugh, and sprang away to put on Jip's new collar. So ended my last attempt to make any change in Dora. I'd been unhappy in trying it. I couldn't endure my own solitary wisdom. I couldn't reconcile it with her former appeal to me as my child wife. I resolved to do what I could, in a quiet way, to improve our proceedings myself. But I foresaw that my utmost would be very little, or I must degenerate into the spider again and be forever lying in wait. And the shadow I've mentioned, that was not to be between us any more, but was to rest wholly on my own heart. How did that fall? The old unhappy feeling pervaded my life. It was deepened, if it were changed at all, but it was as undefined as ever, and addressed me like a strain of sorrowful music faintly heard in the night. I loved my wife dearly, and I was happy, but the happiness I had vaguely anticipated once was not the happiness I enjoyed, and there was always something wanting. In fulfilment of the compact I'd made with myself to reflect my mind on this paper, I again examine it closely and bring its secrets to the light. What I missed, I still regarded, I always regarded, as something that had been a dream of my youthful fancy, that was incapable of realization, that I was now discovering to be so with some natural pain, as all men did. But that it would have been better for me if my wife could have helped me more, and shared the many thoughts in which I had no partner. And that this might have been, I knew. Between these two irreconcilable conclusions, the one that what I felt was general and unavoidable, the other that it was particular to me and might have been different, I balanced curiously with no distinct sense of their opposition to each other. When I thought of the airy dreams of youth that are incapable of realization, I thought of the better state preceding manhood that I had outgrown. And then the contented days with Agnes in the dear old house arose before me, like spectres of the dead that might have some renewal in another world, but never, never more could be reanimated here. Sometimes the speculation came into my thoughts, what might have happened, or what would have happened,
if Dora and I had never known each other. But she was so incorporated with my existence that it was the idlest of all fancies, and would soon rise out of my reach and sight like gossamer floating in the air. I always loved her. What I'm describing slumbered and half awoke and slept again in the innermost recesses of my mind. There was no evidence of it in me. I know of no influence it had in anything I said or did. I bore the weight of all our little cares and all my projects. Dora held the pens, and we both felt that our shares were adjusted as the case required. She was truly fond of me and proud of me. And when Agnes wrote a few earnest words in her letters to Dora of the pride and interest with which my old friends heard of my growing reputation, and read my book as if they heard me speaking its contents, Dora read them out to me with tears of joy in her bright eyes and said I was a dear old clever famous boy. The first mistaken impulse of an undisciplined heart. Those words of Mrs. Strong's were constantly recurring to me at this time, but almost always present to my mind. I awoke with them often in the night. I remember to have even read them in dreams inscribed upon the walls of houses. For I knew now that my own heart was undisciplined when it first loved Dora, and that if it had been disciplined, it never could have felt when we were married what it had felt in its secret experience. There can be no disparity in marriage like unsuitability of mind and purpose. Those words I remembered too. I had endeavoured to adapt Dora to myself and found it impracticable. It remained for me to adapt myself to Dora, to share with her what I could and be happy, to bear on my own shoulders what I must and be happy still. This was the discipline to which I tried to bring my heart when I began to think. It made my second year much happier than my first, and what was better still, made Dora's life all sunshine. But as that year wore on, Dora was not strong. I had hoped that lighter hands than mine would help to mould her character, and that a baby smile upon her breast might change my child wife to a woman. It was not to be. The spirit fluttered for a moment on the threshold of its little prison, and, unconscious of captivity, took wing. "When I can run about again as I used to do, Aunt," said Dora, "I shall make Jip race. He's getting quite slow and lazy." "I suspect, my dear," said my aunt, quietly working by her side, "he has a worse disorder than that. Age, Dora."
"Do you think he's old?"
said Dora, astonished.
"Oh, how strange it seems that Jip should be old."
"It's a complaint we're all liable to, little one, as we get on in life," said my aunt cheerfully. "I don't feel more free from it than I used to be, I assure you."
"But Jip,"
said Dora, looking at him with compassion,
"even little Jip. Oh, poor fellow."
"I dare say he'll last a long time yet, Blossom," said my aunt, patting Dora on the cheek as she leant out of her couch to look at Jip, who responded by standing on his hind legs and balking himself in various asthmatic attempts to scramble up by the head and shoulders. "He must have a piece of flannel in his house this winter, and I shouldn't wonder if he came out quite fresh again with the flowers in the spring."
"Bless the little dog,"
exclaimed my aunt. "If he had as many lives as a cat and was on the point of losing them all, he'd bark at me with his last breath, I believe." Dora had helped him up on the sofa, where he really was defying my aunt to such a furious extent that he couldn't keep straight but barked himself sideways. The more my aunt looked at him, the more he reproached her, for she'd lately taken to spectacles, and for some inscrutable reason he considered the glasses personal. Dora made him lie down by her with a good deal of persuasion, and when he was quiet, drew one of his long ears through and through her hand, repeating thoughtfully, "Even little Jip. Oh, my poor fellow." "His lungs are good enough," said my aunt gaily, "and his dislikes are not at all feeble. He has a good many years before him, no doubt, but if you want a dog to race with Little Blossom, he's lived too well for that, and I'll give you one." "Thank you, aunt," said Dora faintly, "but don't, please." "No," said my aunt, taking off her spectacles. "I couldn't have any other dog but Jip," said Dora. "It would be so unkind to Jip. Besides, I couldn't be such friends with any other dog but Jip, because he wouldn't have known me before I was married, and wouldn't have barked at Dodie when he first came to our house. I couldn't care for any other dog but Jip, I'm afraid, aunt." "To be sure," said my aunt, patting her cheek again, "you're right." "You're not offended," said Dora, "are you?" "Why, what a sensitive pet it is," cried my aunt, bending over her affectionately, "to think that I could be offended." "No, no, I didn't really think so," returned Dora, "but I am a little tired, and it made me silly for a moment. I'm always a silly little thing, you know, but it made me more silly to talk about Jip. He's known me in all that's happened to me, haven't you, Jip? And I couldn't bear to slight him because he was a little altered. Could I, Jip?" Jip nestled closer to his mistress and lazily licked her hand. "You're not so old, Jip, are you, that you leave your mistress yet?" said Dora. "We may keep one another company a little longer." My pretty Dora. When she came down to dinner on the ensuing Sunday, and was so glad to see old Traddles, who always dined with us on Sunday, we thought she would be running about as she used to do in a few days. But they said, "Wait a few days more," and then, "Wait a few days more," and still she neither ran nor walked. She looked very pretty and was very merry, but the little feet that used to be so nimble when they danced round Jip were dull and motionless. I began to carry her downstairs every morning and upstairs every night. She would clasp me round the neck and laugh the while, as if I did it for a wager. Jip would bark and caper round us and go on before and look back on the landing, breathing short to see that we were coming. My aunt, the best and most cheerful of nurses, would trudge after us, a moving mass of shawls and pillows. Mr. Dick would not have relinquished his post of candle-bearer to anyone alive. Traddles would be often at the bottom of the staircase looking on and taking charge of sportive messages from Dora to the dearest girl in the world. We made quite a gay procession of it, and my child wife was the gayest there. But sometimes, when I took her up and felt that she was lighter in my arms, a dead blank feeling came upon me, as if I were approaching to some frozen region yet unseen that numbed my life. I avoided the recognition of this feeling by any name, or by any communing with myself, until one night, when it was very strong upon me, and my aunt had left her with a parting cry of, "Good night, Little Blossom," I sat down at my desk alone, and cried to think, oh, what a fatal name it was, and how the blossom withered in its bloom upon the tree. Chapter 49. I am involved in mystery. I received one morning by the post the following letter, dated Canterbury, and addressed to me at Doctor's Commons, which I read with some surprise. "My dear sir, circumstances beyond my individual control have, for a considerable lapse of time, effected a severance of that intimacy which, in the limited opportunities conceded to me in the midst of my professional duties, of contemplating the scenes and events of the past tinged by the prismatic hues of memory, has ever afforded me, as it ever must continue to afford, gratifying emotions of no common description.
This fact, my dear sir, combined with the distinguished elevation to which your talents have raised you, deters me from presuming to aspire to the liberty of addressing the companion of my youth by the familiar appellation of Copperfield. It is sufficient to know that the name to which I do myself the honour to refer will ever be treasured among the muniments of our house. I allude to the archives connected with our former lodgers preserved by Mrs. Micawber, with sentiments of personal esteem amounting to affection. It is not for one situated through his original errors and a fortuitous combination of unpropitious events, as is the foundered bark, if he may be allowed to assume so maritime a denomination, who now takes up the pen to address you. It is not, I repeat, for one so circumstanced to adopt the language of compliment or of congratulation that he leaves to abler and to purer hands. If your more important avocation should admit of your ever tracing these imperfect characters thus far, which may be or may not be as circumstances arise, you will naturally inquire by what object am I influenced then in inditing the present missive. Allow me to say that I fully defer to the reasonable character of that inquiry and proceed to develop it, premising that it is not an object of a pecuniary nature. Without more directly referring to any latent ability that may possibly exist on my part of wielding the thunderbolt, or directing the devouring and avenging flame in any quarter, I may be permitted to observe in passing that my brightest visions are for ever dispelled, that my peace is shattered, and my power of enjoyment destroyed, that my heart is no longer in the right place, and that I no more walk erect before my fellow man. The canker is in the flower. The cup is bitter to the brim. The worm is at his work and will soon dispose of his victim. The sooner, the better. But I will not digress. Placed in a mental position of peculiar painfulness, beyond the assuaging reach even of Mrs. Micawber's influence, though exercised in the tripartite character of woman, wife, and mother, it is my intention to fly from myself for a short period and devote a respite of 8 and 40 hours to revisit some metropolitan scenes of past enjoyment. Among other havens of domestic tranquillity and peace of mind, my feet will naturally tend towards the King's Bench Prison. In stating that I shall be D.V. on the outside of the south wall of that place of incarceration on civil process the day after tomorrow at 7 in the evening precisely, my object in this epistolary communication is accomplished. I do not feel warranted in soliciting my former friend Mr. Copperfield, or my former friend Mr. Thomas Traggles of the Inner Temple, if that gentleman is still existent and forthcoming, to condescend to meet me, and renew, so far as may be, our past relations of the olden time. I confine myself to throwing out the observation that, at the hour and place I have indicated, may be found such ruined vestiges as yet remain of a fallen tower, Wilkins Micawber. P.S. It may be advisable to superadd to the above the statement that Mrs. Micawber is not in confidential possession of my intentions. I read the letter over several times, making due allowance for Mr. Micawber's lofty style of composition and for the extraordinary relish with which he sat down and wrote long letters on all possible and impossible occasions. I still believe that something important lay hidden at the bottom of this roundabout communication. I put it down to think about it, and took it up again to read it once more, and put it down again for further reflection, and had rung these changes very often and was still pursuing them when Traddles found me in the height of my perplexity. "My dear fellow," said I never was better pleased to see you. You come to give me the benefit of your sober judgment at a most opportune time. I've received a very singular letter, Traddles, from Mr. Micawber. "No," cried Traddles, "you don't say so. And I've received one from Mrs. Micawber." With that, Traddles, who was flushed with walking and whose hair, under the combined effects of exercise and excitement, stood on end as if he saw a cheerful ghost, produced his letter and made an exchange with me. I watched him into the heart of Mr. Micawber's letter, and returned the elevation of eyebrows with which he said, "Wielding the thunderbolt, or directing the devouring and avenging flame, bless me, Copperfield." And then I ended on the perusal of Mrs. Micawber's epistle. It ran thus: "My best regards to Mr. Thomas Traddles, and if he should still remember one who formerly had the happiness of being well acquainted with him, may I beg a few moments of his leisure time? I assure Mr. T.T. that I would not intrude upon his kindness were I in any other position than on the confines of distraction. Though harrowing to myself to mention, the alienation of Mr. Micawber, formerly so domesticated, from his wife and family, is the cause of my addressing my unhappy appeal to Mr. Traddles, and soliciting his best indulgence. Mr. T. can form no adequate idea of the change in Mr. Micawber's conduct, of his wildness, of his violence. It has gradually augmented until it assumes the appearance of aberration of intellect. Scarcely a day passes, I assure Mr. Traddles, on which some paroxysm doesn't take place. Mr. T. will not require me to depict my feelings when I inform him that I have become accustomed to hear Mr. Micawber assert that he has sold himself to the D. Mystery and secrecy have long been his principal characteristic, have long replaced unlimited confidence. The slightest provocation, even being asked if there is anything he'd prefer for dinner, causes him to express a wish for a separation. Last night, on being childishly solicited for tuppence to buy lemon stunners, a local sweetmeat, he presented an oyster knife at the twins. I entreat Mr. Traddles to bear with me in entering into these details. Without them, Mr. T. would indeed find it difficult to form the faintest conception of my heart-rending situation. May I now venture to confide to Mr. T. the purport of my letter? Will he now allow me to throw myself on his friendly consideration? Oh, yes, for I know his heart. The quick eye of affection is not easily blinded when of the female sex. Mr. Micawber is going to London. Though he studiously concealed his hand this morning before breakfast in writing the direction card which he attached to the little brown valise of happier days, the eagle glance of matrimonial anxiety detected D.O.N. distinctly traced. The West End destination of the coach is the Golden Cross. Dare I fervently implore Mr. T. to see my misguided husband and to reason with him? Dare I ask Mr. T. to endeavour to step in between Mr. Micawber and his agonised family? Oh, no, for that would be too much. If Mr. Copperfield should yet remember one unknown to fame, will Mr. T. take charge of my unalterable regards and similar entreaties? In any case, he will have the benevolence to consider this communication strictly private, and on no account whatever to be alluded to, however distantly, in the presence of Mr. Micawber. If Mr. T. should ever reply to it, which I cannot but feel to be most improbable, a letter addressed to M.E., Post Office, Canterbury, will be fraught with less painful consequences than any addressed immediately to one who subscribes herself in extreme distress, Mr. Thomas Traddles, respectful friend and suppliant, Emma Micawber." "What do you think of that letter?" said Traddles, casting his eyes upon me when I'd read it twice. "What do you think of the other?" said I, for he was still reading it with knitted brows. "I think that the two together, Copperfield," replied Traddles, "mean more than Mr. and Mrs. Micawber usually mean in their correspondence. But I don't know what. They're both written in good faith, I have no doubt, and without any collusion. Poor thing!" He was now alluding to Mrs. Micawber's letter, and we were standing side by side comparing the two. "It will be a charity to write to her at all events and tell her that we will not fail to see Mr. Micawber." I acceded to this the more readily because I now reproached myself with having treated her former letter rather lightly.
It had set me thinking a good deal at the time, as I've mentioned in its place. But my absorption in my own affairs, my experience of the family, and my hearing nothing more, had gradually ended in my dismissing the subject. I'd often thought of the Micawbers, but chiefly to wonder what pecuniary liabilities they were establishing in Canterbury, and to recall how shy Mr. Micawber was of me when he became clerk to Uriah Heep. However, I now wrote a comforting letter to Mrs. Micawber in our joint names, and we both signed it. As we walked into town to post it, Traddles and I held a long conference and launched into a number of speculations which I need not repeat. We took my aunt into our councils in the afternoon, but our only decided conclusion was that we would be very punctual in keeping Mr. Micawber's appointment. Although we appeared at the stipulated place a quarter of an hour before the time, we found Mr. Micawber already there. He was standing with his arms folded over against the wall, looking at the spikes on the top with a sentimental expression, as if they were the interlacing boughs of trees that had shaded him in his youth. When we accosted him, his manner was something more confused and something less genteel than of yore. He had relinquished his legal suit of black for the purposes of this excursion, and wore the old surtout and tights, but not quite with the old air. He gradually picked up more and more of it as we conversed with him, but his very eyeglass seemed to hang less easily, and his shirt collar, though still of the old formidable dimensions, rather drooped. "Gentlemen," said Mr. Micawber, after the first salutations, "you are friends indeed and friends indeed. Allow me to offer my inquiries with reference to the physical welfare of Mrs. Copperfield in S.A. and Mrs. Traddles in posse, presuming, that is to say, that my friend Mr. Traddles is not yet united to the object of his affections for weal and for woe." We acknowledged his politeness and made suitable replies. He then directed our attention to the wall, and was beginning, "I assure you, gentlemen," when I ventured to object to that ceremonious form of address, and to beg that he would speak to us in the old way. "My dear Copperfield," he returned, pressing my hand, "your cordiality overpowers me. This reception of a shattered fragment of the temple once called man, if I may be permitted so to express myself, bespeaks a heart that is an honour to our common nature. I was about to observe that I again behold the serene spot where some of the happiest hours of my existence fleeted by." "Made so, I'm sure, by Mrs. Micawber," said I. "I hope she is well." "Thank you," returned Mr. Micawber, whose face clouded at this reference. "She is but so-so." "And this," said Mr. Micawber, nodding his head sorrowfully, "is the bench, where, for the first time in many revolving years, the overwhelming pressure of pecuniary liabilities was not proclaimed from day to day by importunate voices declining to vacate the passage, where there was no knocker on the door for any creditor to appeal to, where personal service of process was not required, and detainers were merely lodged at the gate. Gentlemen," said Mr. Micawber, "when the shadow of that ironwork on the summit of the brick structure has been reflected on the gravel of the parade, I have seen my children thread the mazes of the intricate pattern, avoiding the dark marks. I have been familiar with every stone in the place. If I betray weakness, you will know how to excuse me." "We've all got on in life since then, Mr. Micawber," said I. "Mr. Copperfield," returned Mr. Micawber bitterly, "when I was an inmate of that retreat, I could look my fellow man in the face and punch his head if he offended me. My fellow man and myself are no longer on those glorious terms." Turning from the building in a downcast manner, Mr. Micawber accepted my proffered arm on one side and the proffered arm of Traddles on the other, and walked away between us. There are
some landmarks,' observed Mr. Micawber, looking fondly back over his shoulder. "'On the road to the tomb, which, but for the impiety of the aspiration, a man would wish never to have passed. Such is the bench in my chequered career.' "'Oh, you are in low spirits, Mr. Micawber,' said Traddles. "'I am, sir,' interposed Mr. Micawber. "'I hope,' said Traddles, "'it's not because you've conceived a dislike to the law, "'for I'm a lawyer myself, you know.' "'Mr. Micawber answered not a word. "'How is our friend Heap, Mr. Micawber?' said I, after a silence. "'My dear Copperfield!' returned Mr. Micawber, bursting into a state of much excitement and turning pale. "'If you ask after my employer as your friend, I am sorry for it. "'If you ask after him as my friend, I sardonically smile at it. "'In whatever capacity you ask after my employer, I beg, without offence to you, "'to limit my reply to this, that whatever his state of health may be, "'his appearance is foxy, not to say diabolical.' "'You will allow me, as a private individual, "'to decline pursuing a subject "'which has lashed me to the utmost verge of desperation "'in my professional capacity.' "'I expressed my regret for having innocently touched upon a theme "'that roused him so much. "'May I ask,' said I, without any hazard of repeating the mistake, "'how my old friends Mr. and Miss Wickfield are?'
"'Miss Wickfield!'
"'said Mr. Micawber, now turning burning red, "'is, as she always is, a pattern and a bright example. "'My dear Copperfield, she is the only starry spot in a miserable existence. "'My respect for that young lady, my admiration of her character, "'my devotion to her for her love and truth and goodness,' "'Take me,' said Mr. Micawber, down a turning, "'for upon my soul, in my present state of mind, "'I am not equal to this.' "'We wheeled him off into a narrow street, "'where he took out his pocket handkerchief "'and stood with his back to a wall. "'If I looked as gravely at him as Traddles did, "'he must have found our company by no means inspiriting.
"'It is my fate.'
"'said Mr. Micawber, unfeignedly sobbing, "'but doing even that with a shadow of the old expression "'of doing something genteel.
"'It is my fate, gentlemen, "'that the finer feelings of our nature "'have become reproaches to me. "'My homage to Miss Wickfield "'is a flight of arrows in my bosom. "'You had better leave me, if you please, "'to walk the earth as a vagabond.' "'The worm will settle my business in double-quick time.'
"'Without attending to this invocation, "'we stood by until he put up his pocket-handkerchief, "'pulled up his shirt-collar, "'and, to delude any person in the neighbourhood "'who might have been observing him, "'hummed a tune with his hat very much on one side. "'I then mentioned, "'not knowing what might be lost "'if we lost sight of him yet, "'that it would give me great pleasure "'to introduce him to my aunt "'if he would ride out to Highgate,' where a bed was at his service. "'You shall make us a glass of your own punch, Mr. Micawber,' said I, "'and forget whatever you have on your mind in pleasanter reminiscences. "'Or, if confiding anything to friends will be more likely to relieve you, "'you shall impart it to us, Mr. Micawber,' said Traddles prudently.
"'Gentlemen,' returned Mr. Micawber, "'do with me as you will. I am a straw upon the surface of the deep, and am tossed in all directions by the elephants.
I beg your pardon, I should have said the elements. We walked on, arm in arm again, found the coach in the act of starting, and arrived at Highgate without encountering any difficulties by the way. I was very uneasy and very uncertain in my mind what to say or do for the best. So was Traddles, evidently. Mr. Micawber was, for the most part, plunged into deep gloom. He occasionally made an attempt to smarten himself and hum the fag end of a tune, but his relapses into profound melancholy were only made the more impressive by the mockery of a hat exceedingly on one side and a shirt collar pulled up to his eyes. We went to my aunt's house, rather than to mine, because of Dora's not being well.
My aunt presented herself on being sent for and welcomed Mr. Micawber with gracious cordiality. Mr. Micawber kissed her hand, retired to the window, and pulling out his pocket handkerchief, had a mental wrestle with himself. Mr. Dick was at home. He was by nature so exceedingly compassionate of anyone who seemed to be ill at ease, and was so quick to find any such person out, that he shook hands with Mr. Micawber at least half a dozen times in 5 minutes. To Mr. Micawber, in his trouble, this warmth on the part of a stranger was so extremely touching that he could only say, on the occasion of each successive shake, "My dear sir, you overpower me," which gratified Mr. Dick so much that he went at it again with greater vigour than before. "The friendliness of this gentleman," said Mr. Micawber to my aunt, "if you will allow me, ma'am, to cull a figure of speech from the vocabulary of our coarser national sports, floors me. To a man who is struggling with a complicated burden of perplexity and disquiet, such a reception is trying, I assure you." "My friend, Mr. Dick," replied my aunt proudly, "is not a common man." "That I am convinced of," said Mr. Micawber. "My dear sir," for Mr. Dick was shaking hands with him again, "I am deeply sensible of your cordiality." "How do you find yourself?" said Mr. Dick with an anxious look. "Indifferent, my dear sir," returned Mr. Micawber, sighing. "You must keep up your spirits," said Mr. Dick, "and make yourself as comfortable as possible." Mr. Micawber was quite overcome by these friendly words, and by finding Mr. Dick's hand again within his own. "It has been my lot," he observed, "to meet in the diversified panorama of human existence with an occasional oasis, but never with one so green, so gushing as the present." At another time I should have been amused by this, but I felt that we were all constrained and uneasy, and I watched Mr. Micawber so anxiously in his vacillations between an evident disposition to reveal something and a counter-disposition to reveal nothing, that I was in a perfect fever. Traddles, sitting on the edge of his chair, with his eyes wide open and his hair more emphatically erect than ever, stared by turns at the ground and at Mr. Micawber, without so much as attempting to put in a word. My aunt, though I saw that her shrewdest observation was concentrated on her new guest, had more useful possession of her wits than either of us, for she held him in conversation and made it necessary for him to talk, whether he liked it or not. "You're a very old friend of my nephew's, Mr. Micawber," said my aunt. "I wish I'd had the pleasure of seeing you before." "Madam," returned Mr. Micawber, "I wish I had had the honour of knowing you at an earlier period. I was not always the wreck you at present behold." "I hope Mrs. Micawber and your family are well, sir," said my aunt. Mr. Micawber inclined his head. "They are as well, ma'am," he desperately observed after a pause, "as aliens and outcasts can ever hope to be." "Lord bless you, sir," exclaimed my aunt in her abrupt way. "What are you talking about?" "The subsistence of my family, ma'am," returned Mr. Micawber, "trembles in the balance. My employer..." Here Mr. Micawber provokingly left off, and began to peel the lemons that had been under my directions set before him, together with all the other appliances he used in making punch. "Your employer, you know," said Mr. Dick, jogging his arm as a gentle reminder. "My good sir," returned Mr. Micawber, "you recall me. I'm obliged to you." They shook hands again. "My employer, ma'am, Mr. Heap, once did me the favour to observe to me that if I were not in the receipt of the stipendiary emoluments appertaining to my engagement with him, I should probably be a mountebank about the country swallowing a sword blade and eating the devouring element. For anything that I can perceive to the contrary, it is still probable that my children may be reduced to seek a livelihood by personal contortion, while Mrs. Micawber abets their unnatural feats by playing the barrel organ." Mr. Micawber, with a random but expressive flourish of his knife,
signified that these performances might be expected to take place after he was no more, then resumed his peeling with a desperate air. My aunt leant her elbow on the little round table that she usually kept beside her and eyed him attentively. Notwithstanding the aversion with which I regarded the idea of entrapping him into any disclosure he wasn't prepared to make voluntarily, I should have taken him up at this point but for the strange proceedings in which I saw him engaged, whereof his putting the lemon peel into the kettle, the sugar into the snuffer tray, the spirit into the empty jug, and confidently attempting to pour boiling water out of a candlestick, were among the most remarkable. I saw that a crisis was at hand, and it came. He clattered all his means and implements together, rose from his chair, pulled out his pocket handkerchief, and burst into tears.
"My dear Copperfield," said Mr. Micawber behind his handkerchief, "this is an occupation of all others requiring an untroubled mind and self-respect. I cannot perform it. It is out of the question."
"Mr. Micawber," said I, "what's the matter? Pray speak out. You are among friends."
"Among friends, sir," repeated Mr. Micawber, and all he had reserved came breaking out of him. "Good heavens! It is principally because I am among friends that my state of mind is what it is. What is the matter, gentlemen? What is not the matter? Villainy is the matter. Baseness is the matter. Deception, fraud, conspiracy are the matter. And the name of the whole atrocious mass is Heep."
My aunt clapped her hands and we all started up as if we were possessed.
"The struggle is over," said Mr. Micawber, violently gesticulating with his pocket handkerchief and fairly striking out from time to time with both arms as if he were swimming under superhuman difficulties. "I will lead this life no longer. I am a wretched being cut off from everything that makes life tolerable. I have been under a taboo in that infernal scoundrel service. Give me back my wife. Give me back my family. Substitute Micawber for the petty wretch who walks about in the boots at present on my feet, and call upon me to swallow a sword tomorrow, and I'll do it with a nappy choice."
I never saw a man so hot in my life. I tried to calm him that we might come to something rational, but he got hotter and hotter and wouldn't hear a word.
"I'll put my hand in no man's hand," said Mr. Micawber, gasping, puffing and sobbing to that degree that he was like a man fighting with cold water, "until I have blown to fragments the detestable serpent Heep. I'll partake of no one's hospitality until I have moved Mount Vesuvius to eruption on the abandoned rascal Heap. Refreshment underneath this roof, particularly punch, would choke me unless I had previously choked the eyes out of the head of interminable cheat and liar Heap. I'll know nobody and say nothing and live nowhere until I have crushed to undiscoverable atoms the transcendent and immortal hypocrite and perjurer Heap."
I really had some fear of Mr. Micawber's dying on the spot. The manner in which he struggled through these inarticulate sentences, and whenever he found himself getting near the name of Heap, fought his way on to it, dashed at it in a fainting state and brought it out with a vehemence little less than marvellous, was frightful. But now, when he sank into a chair, steaming, and looked at us with every possible colour in his face that had no business there, and an endless procession of lumps following one another in hot haste up his throat, whence they seemed to shoot into his forehead, he had the appearance of being in the last extremity. I would have gone to his assistance, but he waved me off and wouldn't hear a word.
"No, Copperfield!
No communication until Miss Wickfield redress from wrongs inflicted by consummate scoundrel.
I'm quite convinced he couldn't have uttered three words but for the amazing energy with which this word inspired him when he felt it coming.
In fire!